Welcome to the Shortwave Report for December 2nd, 2011. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK World Radio Japan, China Radio International, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, and The Voice of Russia. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan. For the second time in a month, Japan has banned rice found to be contaminated with cesium. Pakistan says that the NATO attack that killed 24 was deliberate. In an Insight episode, a Pakistani journalist describes the citizen and national reaction to the provocative attack by NATO. NHK World Radio Japan.
Japan's government has banned rice shipments from two districts in Fukushima Prefecture after samples were found to be contaminated with radioactive cesium above the state limit. Chief Cabinet Secretary Osamu Fujimura said on Tuesday that he instructed the prefecture's governor to suspend shipments of rice harvested this year in the districts in Date City. The areas are about 60 kilometers from the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Fujimura said 9 kilograms of contaminated rice has been sold to consumers and that the prefectural government is trying to find out whether it has been consumed. In October, Fukushima Prefecture said all rice harvested in the prefecture this year had been cleared for shipment with radioactivity levels below the government standard. But this month, the prefectural government found contaminated rice in a district in Fukushima City, about 60 kilometers from the plant. Shipments of rice from the district have been suspended.
Pakistan says the NATO cross-border air attack on Saturday that killed 24 of its soldiers was deliberate, disputing claims that it was an accident. Pakistan's military on Wednesday released video footage of what is said was the aftermath of the strike on its two military posts. The military spokesman said both posts are located atop hills and could be easily spotted, and that NATO forces have been informed of their location. He said Pakistan cannot accept the explanation that the international forces mistook its soldiers for armed insurgents. Pakistan's Cable TV Association on Wednesday announced it will stop relaying broadcasts of Western TV networks that present a negative image of Pakistan in protest at the NATO attack. It said BBC's broadcasts have gone off air. Anger is growing in Pakistan, with rallies condemning the attack being held every day. The country's Lawyers Association held a strike to protest the air attack.
In today's edition of Insight, the well-known Pakistani journalist Ilfan Siddiqui speaks to us about the NATO strike in Pakistani territory that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers on Saturday. On Sunday, about 1,200 people staged a protest in Pakistan's largest city of Karachi. Hundreds of people also rallied in the capital of Islamabad. How are ordinary people in Pakistan reacting to the NATO assault?
دیکھئے رد عمل میرا خیال یہ ہے کہ دن بدن شدید ہوتا چلا جا رہا ہے جب کوئی ایک آدھ واقعہ ہوتا ہے
If you look at the number of people who participated in the rallies, you might think that the number is very small and people with anti-American feelings are in the minority. You would be mistaken in thinking this way, however. Feelings of hatred for the US are running very strong in Pakistan. even among people who did not participate in the rallies, whether they are right-wing or left-wing, liberal or not, from the elite or not, religious or otherwise. A feeling of hatred in response to the American action is commonplace. This feeling is only likely to grow stronger, not weaker, as time passes.
How do you think things will unfold within Pakistan?
Even before the incident, there were other tricky foreign policy issues facing Pakistan. One recent revelation seems to indicate that a high-level Pakistani official passed a memo to the U.S. government suggesting that certain members of the Pakistani government were hoping to strengthen their control over the South Asian nation's military leadership with American help in the wake of the killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. There is much debate about how much truth is to be found in this tale, and the legal case is set to go before the Supreme Court of Pakistan. Overall, then, the situation in Pakistan was already unstable, to which context has been added the problem of the NATO strike. This will only increase the tension between the civilian leadership and the army, with the latter under increasing domestic and international pressure. This could result in the army taking the reins of government, something that has happened time and again in the course of Pakistan's relatively short history. Despite the fact that neither the army leadership nor the people of Pakistan want a military takeover, the possibility of the army reaching the conclusion that it must take a leadership role for the country as a whole is increasing.
In today's edition of Insight, Pakistani journalist Ilfan Siddiqui gave us his thoughts on the NATO strike in Pakistani territory that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers on Saturday.
In South Korea, demonstrations continue nationwide against a critical free trade agreement with the United States. On Wednesday night, about 20,000 people gathered near the parliament building in the capital, Seoul, one day after President Lee Myung-bak signed the bills required to implement the FTA with the United States. The demonstration, one of the largest, was organized by an internet radio station. Protesters, including students and company workers, criticized the ruling party for approving the deal, naming each lawmaker who supported the bills. Together, they sang a song denouncing President Yi and demanding immediate withdrawal from the trade pact. Nationwide demonstrations continue in South Korea not only among farmers who would be directly affected by the FTA, but also among young people who are dissatisfied with severe employment conditions and a widening income gap. Criticism is rising that only a handful of large corporations would benefit from the deal. The bills to ratify the FTA were already passed by a parliament in late November, despite opposition lawmakers' attempts to block voting. The trade deal is expected to take effect as early as January 1st.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110, or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, China Radio International. China is making it easier for Beijing residents to purchase, register, and use electric vehicles. China Radio International.
You're unlikely to see an electric car on the streets of Beijing. But city authorities want to change that. Currently, only a limited amount of vehicle license plates are issued each month, so getting one can take a long time and needs a lot of luck. But the Beijing government says electric car buyers can now skip the queue to register their vehicle immediately. They may also qualify for a subsidy of up to $19,000. But despite the financial help, electric cars are still expensive. Jody Xuan is a clean transport analyst for international environmental consultancy China Green Tech Initiative.
We don't think this policy will make a huge impact in the market, at least in the near term, because as you may already know that the EV cost is very, very high. It's usually about twice or three times more expensive than a similar traditional car.
On top of the expense, there's also very few recharging stations in the city. But that should change soon, as the government plans to build 4,000 over the next 4 years and another 6,000 by 2020. and experts predict the price of electric cars will eventually come down. Jack de Sellier is head of Going Electric, a Brussels-based organisation lobbying for greater use of electric vehicles.
Just think of the first mobile phones just 25 years ago. They weighed 900 grams and they costed something like $4,000. You know, today they weigh a few tens of grams and they cost down to a few tens of dollars.
If electric cars are eventually going to catch on in China, it's the public that needs to be persuaded. But are they?
Recharging will be an issue, and I think electric cars are less powerful than normal vehicles. But they are environmentally friendly.
People in Beijing will buy them. The new policy will make it quicker to apply for registration.
We could do with more electric cars in Beijing. Protecting the environment is very important now. The air pollution is not so good in the city.
China has high hopes for its electric car market. By 2020, the country plans to be producing 1 million of the new vehicles per year. For CRI, I'm Dominic Swan.
That report was from China Radio International, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 11970 and from 6 p.m. to 11 at either 9790, 6020 or 6190 or on the web at english.cri.cn. On to Spanish National Radio, an editorial from Spanish newspaper El País on how the U.S. attempts to solve its economic crises revealed the real motivation of most politicians to win the next election. 8 out of 10 Spaniards do not believe taxes are collected fairly. Israel fired missiles back at Lebanon, while Spain reiterated the need for Israel to cease illegal settlement construction. The world is getting hotter, and human beings are to blame, according to the World Meteorological Association at the United Nations climate talks in Durban, South Africa. Spanish National Radio.
Turning to the opinion pages, El País prints two editorials, one headlined "The Essential and the Urgent," saying that Spaniards expect an immediate announcement from Prime Minister-elect Rajoy on taxes and the labor market, and the other headlined "United States Paralysis," on the failure of the U.S. Congressional Committee charged with reaching an agreement on how to resolve the country's problems of public debt and deficit due to partisan positions that, in the end, caused them to put off important economic decisions until after next year's elections. On the one hand, says the editorial, the Republicans are satisfied because they have increased the workload of President Barack Obama's administration and decreased the chances of Obama's re-election, while, on the other hand, the postponement of any decision leaves the Democrats feeling less responsible for the situation, thanks to the apparent short-sightedness of their political rivals. The editorial concludes by saying that what we're seeing now in the United States, and have already seen in Europe, is that winning elections is more important to our political leaders than is saving their respective countries from suffering.
8 out of every 10 Spaniards do not believe taxes are collected fairly. Nearly 83% believe that those who should pay more taxes don't, and more than half say themselves that they pay too much.
Israel has fired several missiles into the southern Lebanese town of Ait Ashab in response to the shooting of Katusha rockets from Lebanon into northern Israel. Officials say Israeli rockets caused only material damage, and no casualties or major damage were reported on the Israeli side, and no one claimed responsibility for the attack. The Israeli army said it holds the Lebanese government and the army responsible for preventing rocket fire at Israel.
The UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, headed by Spain, also confirmed the attack and urged maximum restraint to prevent an escalation. Meanwhile, the Israeli ambassador in Madrid, Alon Bar, has reiterated his view that Spain's approval of Palestine's admission to UNESCO was a mistake, and has said he hopes for a qualitative leap in bilateral relations once Conservative Prime Minister-elect Mariano Rajoy takes power. Spain's foreign minister until the next government, Trinidad Jiménez, has insisted that the Popular Party shares the socialist belief in a two-state solution.
Israel.
I would call on Israel to stop the construction of illegal settlements because that would be the best sign that Israel wants to return to the negotiating table with Palestine. The world is getting hotter and human beings are to blame. 2011 has been the hottest year since temperatures were recorded in 1850, according to a report released today by the World Meteorological Association. It warned increasing global average temperatures were expected to amplify floods, droughts, and other extreme weather patterns.
The report was released to coincide with UN climate talks, which run until December the 9th in Durban, South Africa, aimed at trying to reach agreement on cutting planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions. The talks are attended by representatives from nearly 200 nations. Biggest emitters, the United States and China, remain unwilling to commit to emission cuts until the others do first. Japan, Canada and Russia don't want to extend their Kyoto promises that expire next year, and the European Union is putting off until 2015 the deadline for a new global accord.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, now heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 5970, and podcasting at www.rtve.es. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. A viewpoint on the UN climate talks in Durban, South Africa, describing the politics of the meeting and raising questions about the influence of wars on climate change. Millions of public sector workers in the UK staged a massive strike against pension cuts and other austerity measures. Radio Havana, Cuba.
20 years ago, global warming was not an issue to be discussed in an international summit. For this reason, the UN conferences taking place year after year to discuss the subject has some merit. It expresses a growing awareness of both the general public and institutions, although taking actions has been rather slow for a matter impacting human survival. The most recent conference of this kind began in the South African city of Durban on Tuesday. The idea of the event was not to analyze the already established agreements. It was a pessimistic effort to find a common position. Contradictions arise mostly from the economic powers, which have given a boost to industrial development based on consumer models and polluting practices, but who now, with the need for change, try to protect entrepreneurs and corporations financially. The United States, the world's greatest polluter, will not sign any agreements. Just as they refused to commit to the Kyoto Protocol, the American delegation arrived at Durban reluctant to sign any binding agreement for 2020. Their main argument being that China and other emerging economic powers must be subjected to the same measures, even though their level of development is not the same. The U.S. will not acknowledge that most highly polluting industries in the third world are often American or European companies, because third world countries see themselves forced to relax their environmental regulations to achieve foreign investment. China, the engine of global economy, is considered a developing country, with social indicators far from those of the developed world. Most of its development is on the East Coast, but inland, there is still a lot of work to be done. Nevertheless, Beijing's efforts to help the environment are more significant than those implemented by the United States, which has only reduced its greenhouse gas emissions by 6% when compared to 2005. This despite the $90 billion President Obama promised towards clean energy. Washington wants a green fund, to which poor nations will contribute monetarily like the major powers. Hopefully, one day the United States will be motivated to implement this egalitarian approach to decisions made by the United Nations, the World Bank, or the IMF. The environmental issue is just one side to the major crisis. Is the environmental damage being narrowly analyzed? Gaseous pollutants are harmful, but what about war? Is the environmental damage being narrowly analyzed? Gaseous pollutants are harmful, but what about war? is the depleted uranium used by the military industry to make more powerful bombs not harmful? What about the human and material damage caused by war, even just current ones? These are issues that need to be addressed at such meetings. For Radio Havana Cuba's editorial desk, I am Lauren Gomez.
Millions of British public sector workers are staging a strike over pensions in what unions say could be the biggest walkout for a generation. Thousands of schools are closed and hospital operations have been cancelled. Courts and government offices were closed on Wednesday as airports and seaports were also affected by the massive strike action. British Economy Minister George Osborne urged workers to continue talks with the government, saying that strikes would not achieve anything. But unions are holding firm and say they completely reject government plans to make their members pay more and work longer hours to earn their pensions. The strike is having its effects across the United Kingdom. In Scotland, only 30 of the 2,700 council-run schools are open, while in Wales, 80% of schools are closed. In Northern Ireland, 3 of the 5 education library boards have reported that over 50% of 1,200 schools are closed. There are no bus or train services operating in Northern Ireland. And unions estimate that about 300,000 public sector workers are on strike in Scotland, while 170,000 workers in Wales are not showing up for work today. Plane arrivals and departures at Britain's 2 biggest airports, Heathrow and Gatwick, are said to be largely unaffected, with only a few cancellations of inbound transatlantic flights to Heathrow. British unions say up to 2 million public sector workers are taking part in the strike to protest the pension reform. The UK government says the cost of funding public sector pensions is unsustainable as people are living longer, but workers say their proposals will force union members to pay more and work longer for less.
Those reports were from Radio Havana Cuba, heard from 2 to 3 p.m. at 11760 and from 5 to 11 p.m. at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 5 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please help if you can. It is the only source of funding for this weekly show. We'll conclude with the voice of Russia. Several scientists have reported evidence that NATO and the U.S. used depleted uranium weapons in overthrowing Libya. The story includes the history of using depleted uranium munitions and the long-term consequences to humans and the environment. The Voice of Russia.
Although NATO has repeatedly denied using depleted uranium during its bombing campaign in Libya, some experts insist that the highly poisonous substance was used during the operation. Writing on the website VoltaireNet.org, Mahdi Nazimroya, a research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization, claimed that a group of nuclear scientists have conducted field surveys at bomb sites in Libya looking for radioactive isotopes. According to Nazimroya, samples from these sites were analyzed at the Nuclear Energy Institution of the Libyan Jamahiriya, and traces of depleted uranium were confirmed.
Khan Halinan, a columnist with the online journal Foreign Policy in Focus, told RT Television in April, at the peak of the campaign, that after examining the impact wounds left on tanks in Libya, he too was almost certain that depleted uranium was being utilized. Referring to the use of depleted uranium munitions, he said, "Politically, it's a bad idea. Medically, it's an extremely bad idea. It's just one of those things that's an effective weapon that you just have to step away from."
Depleted uranium bombs, or dirty bombs as they're also known, were first developed by the United States in 1968. Israel then tested them under U.S. supervision during the 1973 Yom Kippur War between Israel and allied Arab states, and the technology was later sold to at least 29 other countries, though it wasn't used again until the 1991 Gulf War. Dirty bombs were also used in the 1999 NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, and in 2004, during the war in Iraq, the U.S. used depleted uranium to bomb the city of Fallujah.
The U.S.'s use of depleted uranium in Fallujah had devastating consequences for civilians, as a BBC study from July 2010 showed that cases of childhood cancer in the region have increased 12-fold since the bombing. Since the attack, Iraq has also had the world's highest rate of leukemia, and the ratio of male-to-female births has also declined remarkably. Combined with the spread of diseases indicative of genetic damage, this data is consistent with symptoms expected from nuclear fallout on a scale equal to that of Hiroshima, or even greater.
According to the British newspaper The Daily Mail, children in Fallujah are being born with numerous physical defects, and experts interviewed by the newspaper maintained that the birth defects are being caused by depleted uranium munitions. Chris Busby, an Ulster University expert in the effects of radiation, said that uranium particles wreck the DNA of sperm and eggs produced by contaminated adults, causing a multitude of birth defects in their children. He said, depleted uranium, normal uranium, and enriched uranium are all mutagens and cause birth defects at quite small concentrations.
Depleted uranium is usually a byproduct of enriched uranium used in nuclear fuel. Its extremely high density makes it an effective material for armor-piercing shells and bullets. Upon impact with a tank or bunker, uranium particles disintegrate, and up to 40% of the uranium, which is still radioactive, turns into a fine powder, which can remain in the atmosphere for years after the conflict ends.
Dr. Doug Roque, the ex-director of the Pentagon's depleted uranium project, says that total decontamination of an area hit with uranium is impossible, as it's an element that has a half-life of 4.5 billion years and has been described as the silent killer that will never stop killing. Roque told RT that he was asked by the U.S. government to lie about the effects of uranium and that most of the crew he worked with is now dead.
The catastrophic effects of depleted uranium on the environment and human health make their use a highly controversial issue. The International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons, consisting of 155 groups in 32 countries, has asked for a ban on the production and military use of depleted uranium weapons. Partially in response to pressure from the coalition, the use of depleted uranium bombs in former Yugoslavia was investigated by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
That committee, however, concluded that there was no consensus view in international legal circles that the use of such weapons violates existing laws regarding what types of weapons can be used in military conflicts. Since 2001, the European Parliament has passed 4 resolutions calling for an immediate ban on the further use of depleted uranium ammunition, with France and Britain consistently rejecting the calls for a moratorium. So far, Belgium and Costa Rica are the only countries that have prohibited the use of uranium weapons in their territory.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030 13665 9840 or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. My goal in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts using a shortwave radio at home, which is simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.